Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Well, good evening to you. Thanks for coming along. It is the Wednesday, May 8th edition of The Ride Home. It's been a rocky road here these last 20 hours or so.
Are you kidding me?
Holy smokes, yeah.
Yeah, so last night I was minding my own business, you know.
In a deep sleep?
No, I was just getting ready for bed.
Yeah, oh, that was late.
Yeah, I was late because I was up doing work, and all of a sudden the, you know, sound, you
the
know,
sky fell.
Emerges from the phone, which
Holy
you can't sleep through. And then I go upstairs to our bedroom, and my husband is sitting groggily on the side of the bed, like, what is happening?
Holy smokes, huh?
Yeah.
And yeah. So everybody's alarm goes off in Western Pennsylvania. I don't think anybody got a good night's sleep here, right? Of course, the animals, if you had pets, cats and or dogs were terrified out of their mind. I mean, I don't think I've ever experienced thunder and lightning like that.
It was like it was inside my house.
Our house was shaking. That's what it felt like expanding and contracting at the same time. It was crazy.
It was absolutely crazy.
The dog was shivering. I mean, just like losing his mind in fear. The cats were burrowed deep into the covers of the bed.
Were they?
And fighting for space between the legs. I mean, it was a mess.
We had a tornado about a decade ago here in Pittsburgh. And that night, or that afternoon when it was happening, our cats all of a sudden ran down to the basement.
They knew.
So they're always my barometer,
sure.
Like what's going on. So I'm looking around for the cats, and I can't find them. And I thought, oh my gosh, they must be down in the basement. So I go down to the basement to look, and they're not there. So I thought, I must be okay. I find out later, they were burrowed so far in the back of the basement, I couldn't even see them.
Yeah.
So much for a barometer.
We couldn't find one of our cats this morning.
Is that right?
Somewhere in the house, yeah, yeah. And so, Lex, you trump Kath and I because you got out of bed and went to your apartment building's basement?
Yeah, I did.
Wait, tell us this, please.
So I also lived in Texas for a year where I was right on the border of Oklahoma. So very used to—
Tornado Alley.
Yeah, I was very much like used to tornadoes, and I don't mess with them. I've driven through the storms that would continue to be tornadoes. It's not fun. And so I heard the tornado warning, and I went, I'm not even going to chance it. So I put one of my cats in a carrier. I put my other cat on a harness.
You're kidding me.
I'm not.
Take a little walk.
And then we just left our apartment and went down into the basement where the washers and dryers are. And we're just sitting there. I was expecting at least someone else to come down and be like, wow, this weather's crazy, huh? And
nobody came down.
No one else came down. So we were down there for 30 minutes until the warning was up. And then we went, all right, that was fun. Let's go back upstairs to bed.
That is awesome.
That's excellent.
Yeah. So
you didn't. Do any laundry during that time just to make the most
of
it?
I don't think I would have had enough time.
Just hung out. That's fine.
And your cat stayed in that that harness the whole time?
Yeah, she was walking around on a leash like she was a dog.
A rule follower cat.
Yeah, somehow. She was screaming. She was not happy, but.
Of course not. And so we're still suffering repercussions. We went off the air here at Word FM for a long time this morning, which, of course, it's been very nice and clean and clear all day
long. Since then, right.
And we're still kind of cobbling along some
Yeah,
sort
we
of,
don't have any. We're only on generator power here in the building.
So who knows what's going on?
I have no papers in front of me.
Neither
I don't
do
believe
I.
I've ever done a ride home without papers in front of me.
So
it's disconcerting.
It's a digital show today.
It is a digital show today, and I'm not in favor of it, John.
But we do welcome you, digital and or otherwise.
We sure do.
We do have a jam-packed show.
We do.
Which we could read about, and we will tell you, but we'll just skip that right through there.
Yeah.
So let's take a look at the news, right? Because you've got the news going on, and as we always do, the top four at four.
For Wednesday, May 8th, 2024, the day after the storm, number one, leaders of some of the largest U.S. public school districts faced questions from a House panel Wednesday about incidents of anti-Semitism in their schools. A Republican-led House Education Subcommittee called Berkeley Unified School Superintendent, the New York City School Chancellor, and the Montgomery County School Board President of Maryland to testify. This is what Representative Aaron Bean said from Florida. Anti-Semitic incidents have exploded in K-12 schools following Hamas's horrific October 7th attack. Jewish teachers, students, and faculty have been denied a safe learning environment and forced to contend with anti-Semitic agitators due to district leaders' inaction. He said that the very need for this hearing is a travesty. A senior committee aide told CBS News the panel didn't issue subpoenas, but it did ask the school district leaders to appear voluntarily. Read more about that at today's CBS News. Number two, in what was easily the most dramatic day of Donald Trump's hush money trial, porn star Stormy Daniels testified yesterday about her alleged encounters with the former president and being paid on the eve of the 2016 election to keep quiet about it. And I'm not going to give you one more detail.
Thank you.
Because it's a family program.
Thank you.
And I am so sick of reading about it. But you can read more at Wall Street Journal today.
Nope.
Number three, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene appeared to retreat from her threat to imminently trigger a vote to remove Speaker Mike Johnson as House leader after lengthy meetings with him this week. Okay, so what could they possibly have to talk about that they don't already know?
Nothing.
I mean, hours of meetings?
Spin. Let's just spin this. Let's waste some time.
Anyway, she says right now the ball is in Mike Johnson's court. I have no idea what that means. She added that the time frame for following through on a promise to force a vote is up to Mike Johnson and it can't drag out. It's from today's CBS News. And number four, huge crowds gathered Wednesday in the southern French city of Marseille, where a majestic three-mast ship carrying the Olympic torch arrived from Greece ahead of a welcoming ceremony at sunset. It looked fabulous.
Excellent.
That's your top four.
Did you see the images of the ship?
Yes.
Isn't that incredibly beautiful?
I couldn't get over it.
No. I mean, you see those and you think, they're out exploring the new world. That's
exactly
what it felt like, you know. That was technology.
Yeah.
That's so incredibly cool.
The torch was lit in Greece last month before it was officially handed to France.
Nice. And so I wonder, is it making its way through France? Are they going to run through the streets like they did, right, oftentimes, so everyone comes out and sees it,
right,
and the torch passes by? It's so cool.
So that ship was first used in 1896.
Cool.
And so it was really, it's just, if you haven't seen any of the photographs, you have to log on.
Okay, we'll take a quick break. We're going to come back. Grieve, breathe, receive. Finding a faith strong enough to hold us. Steve Carter joins us. Willow Creek, that's on the menu here on The Ride Home. We're Pittsburgh's Christian Talk. It's The Ride Home, Word FM.
Grief is a thing that no one wants to deal with. No one wants to live through, and nobody wants to feel.
But we're surrounded by it.
We are, and it's part of life. It is part of the fabric of how this human story is playing out. It just is. I remember before my mom and dad died, I, in talking to one of my therapists, I said, I'm addicted to happiness. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, I can't bear to think about sad things. I won't watch sad movies. I was terrified of that feeling of loss. I think because I just loved my mom and dad so much, and I'd never lost anybody at that point.
Right.
You know what I mean? Seeing God's faithfulness through that process.
The grieving process.
Yeah, is one of the great answered promises that I've seen God work out in my life.
I'm into
really.
That.
And so I was really interested to see this book come across our desks a week ago, Grieve, Breathe, and Receive by author Steve Carter. We're happy to have Steve with us on the program now. Steve, welcome in.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure, Steve. So, Steve, your story hinges on a national news story that a lot of believers followed along, which is the story of Willow Creek Church, where you were the lead pastor. Can you tell our audience, we don't want to presuppose any knowledge, what Willow Creek Church was or is and your involvement there, and then move forward in the story?
Yes. Yeah, so Willow Creek Community Church started in 1975, and when I stepped into my role as a lead teaching pastor in 2018, the church was 7-8 campuses. It was about 25,000 people on weekly attendance. And I was stepping in because my mentor, who was the founder of the church, had gone through a succession process and handed it off to myself and another person. And that announcement had come in 2017, But just a few months after that announcement, allegations of abuse of power and sexual misconduct came to the forefront in the Chicago Tribune. And then it almost was like week after week, more stories started to come out, which led to his resignation and really just put me in a situation where I thought the church needed to handle it in a certain way. And it was not the way that they wanted to handle it. And another story came out in August 5th of 2018 in the New York Times. And it was tragic. It was a story of a former executive assistant, and she was so brave. And I just wanted to stand with her and be just kind of validate her story. And so I resigned and I gave up my dream job. And it was really, really tricky. It was really, really hard to navigate through.
I bet. So you were given essentially a gift wrapped beautifully in a box. And you thought this was one of the career pinnacles in some way. But the gift had a ticking time bomb and then it exploded. So you essentially resigned your position after a short while. Yes?
Definitely. Yeah. It was my dream job. I mean, I was 38 years old. It's everything I've been working for, to be a senior pastor, a church that was well established, doing incredible good in Chicagoland. I was happy and I didn't know these stories. And then you get surprised and it felt like a house of cards and it just started to crumble. And you kind of left trying to pick up the pieces and go, God, what are you doing here? Where are you in all of this?
I think one of the things that seems so difficult to me about your story is that it's not a thing like a disease, which just, you know, comes upon you. It's not like a tornado that hits your house.
An accident that
happened. Yeah, exactly. It seems like, you know, somebody could have made different choices so that this wouldn't have happened to you.
And it wasn't private.
Yeah. So how did that add into your processing of the situation?
That's such a great question, because it almost felt like overnight it was a relational death by suicide. Huh. Because here was a guy who had this established gift of preaching, of leading, of influence. And then after he resigned, he was gone. And you're left kind of trying to pick up the pieces and there's no closure. I step out, there's no closure. And I think what's hard is you have to, I had to wrestle with the question, what do we do when life does what it often does? Mm. When it does shock us, when it does just almost punch us in the gut, when we don't necessarily have the muscles to know how to actually navigate through heartbreak or heartache or loss or change.
Yeah, that's really hard. Well, let me give our listeners the title of the book. It's called Grieve, Breathe, Receive, Finding a Faith Strong Enough to Hold Us by Steve Carter. Steve used to work at Willow Creek Church in the Chicago area. Steve, talk about the three words. Talk about how you discovered them, what the process of moving from one to the other means.
Yeah, so the day after I resigned, I didn't know if I was getting a paycheck. I didn't know what was to come. I woke up, cortisol just pumping through my body going, all right, what do I do now? And I just cried out to God. I was like, Lord, I need to hear something. Please give me something. I didn't hear anything. I kept walking in downtown Madison. Lord, please give me something. Just give me something. And those three words came to my mind, grieve, breathe, receive. Hmm. And I walked to the little coffee shop with donuts, and I just wrote in my journal, grieve what is. Grieve what I thought it was going to be. Grieve how key people let me down. Breathe in new mercies. Exhale all bitterness and resentment. And receive what I need to learn. Receive what I need to own. Receive who I can become because of this. Mm-hmm. And what ended up happening was my family and I, we ended up leaving Chicago and we moved to the desert. And what I found in Holy Weekend actually helped guide me through those three words. Because if you think about Good Friday, something that was profoundly unfair, not right, absolutely unjust happened to Jesus. And if you were the disciples, you didn't know Sunday was coming. So Saturday, you were just hiding out, wondering, what do we do now? What's going to happen? What happened to him? Is it going to happen to us? And then Sunday was the surprise that nobody saw coming. And what I discovered in that is, man, anytime we are in a season of grief, we have to first recognize what day of the weekend are we? Are we in Friday? Are we in Saturday where we're like wandering? It just almost feels like we're back in the desert when the nation of Israel left Egypt. Like where are we? Or are we in a season where we've got to surprise this and we've been able to receive a gift of healing or new opportunity or a new relationship or even just feeling like we've just kind of moved past this desert and grief season? And so I think that the human experience and the experience of any disciple or Christ follower is to be able to hold Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and not just choose one, but when we're in Friday, to recognize, like 1 Thessalonians 4 says, we can grieve with hope. We can grieve knowing that Sunday is coming, that God is working on our very behalf for our healing and for our good.
We're talking with Pastor Steve Carter, former pastor at Willow Creek Church in Chicago. His brand new work is called Grieve, Breathe, Receive, Finding a Faith Strong Enough to Hold Us. Steve, one of the things you said, that part of the process was exhaling all bitterness and resentment. That strikes me as extremely healthy because, I mean, you can grieve, but if you don't get to the bitterness and the resentment, then that season goes on for a long, long time. Yeah?
It's so true. And, you know, people have often asked me, Steve, why do you still love the church? The church hurt you. And I said, no, it didn't. Willow didn't hurt me. Five people did. And my work was actually to practice forgiveness. Because what unforgiveness will do and unresolved grief will do in our hearts and in our bodies, in our souls and in our mind, they're seeds that will create bitterness and rage and gossip and anger. And one of the greatest gifts that our faith gives us is that we are people who can forgive. And so learning to exhale whenever, you know, one of the five names might come to mind, I just started to practice this little breath prayer, cross, release, send it away. And it was based on the two words for forgiveness. The first one is charismai, which Paul uses, which means the grace we receive, we freely give away. And the second word is aphemi, which Jesus uses in the Lord's Prayer, which means to release and send it away. And so whenever any of those five names came to mind, whether I was scrolling on social media or going through just my day and had a memory, I just would stop and just simply say, cross, release, send it away, get it out of my body, send it back to the cross, because I want to make sure that my heart is ready for the day, if it ever comes, when one of the five might want to sit across the table and reconcile. Fabulous. And if they've done their work, but I haven't, I'm going to miss an opportunity for Christ to do what Christ wants to do.
That's really good. Steve, I'm not going to make light of this, but it, in some ways, when I first heard your story, it reminded me of Conan O'Brien, that Conan O'Brien had a gift, and then that was taken away, and there was public humiliation there. He had to kind of go on this journey. So where are you in this mix now? I mean, everybody, you know, kind of sees you. You've written about it. You've processed it. Where are you professionally?
That's a great question. So what's amazing about it is we spent 4 years in the desert and did some great work from spiritual directors, therapists, mentors, just kind of trying to heal well and really walking through grieve, breathe, receive, what it was all about. And I just discovered a much stronger and deeper faith. My son was in eighth grade a couple of years ago, and I just said, hey, we moved you before where you go to high school. I want you to stay and just be able to be grounded and rooted. And I just said, where do you want to go to high school? And without missing a beat, he said, I want to go home. I said, where's home? And he said, to our old neighborhood. So get this, we moved back to our old neighborhood 20 doors down.
That's cool.
Really?
I don't know very many people who move back to their personal Chernobyl.
Excellent.
I am serving in a great church. It's wildly different, but I'm getting to take my experiences and pastor. My family's doing well. And I continue to get to write, to teach, to coach communicators, do a podcast, and just serve people, which thanks be to God for allowing him to heal me and use me still.
Excellent.
Wow.
That's really, really great.
It really is.
I mean, you sound so healthy, Steve.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sure the process was not a simple one, but there it is. It's mm-hmm. in the pages of the new book. So thanks for, you know, just a touch of this. We look forward to further conversations with you, and congratulations on the road forward, especially for being home again.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you both.
Pleasure's ours.
The book is called Grieve, Breathe, Receive, Finding a Faith Strong Enough to Hold Us. We've been talking to author Steve Carter.
Take a quick break. We're going to come back. A little Beethoven mm-hmm. is on the menu. That's next on The Ride Home. At 7 p.m. on May 7th, 1824, Ludwig van Beethoven, then 53, strode onto the stage in Vienna to help conduct the world premiere of the Ninth Symphony, the last symphony that Beethoven would ever complete. That performance, whose 200th anniversary was yesterday, was unforgettable in many ways, but it was marked by an incident at the start of the second movement that revealed to the audience of about 1,800 people how deaf the revered composer had become. Ted Albright, who is a professor emeritus of musicology at Kent State University and author of the Ninth Symphony, described the scene. He said, "The movement began with loud kettle drums, and the crowd cheered wildly. But Beethoven was oblivious to the applause and his music. He stood with his back to the audience, beating time. And at that moment, a soloist grasped his sleeve and turned him around to see the raucous adulation that he could not hear. It was one more humiliation for the composer, who had been mortified by his deafness since he began to lose his hearing in his early 20s. But why did Beethoven go deaf? And why has he been plagued by unrelenting cramps and diarrhea throughout of his life?" So there's been a cottage industry of fans who have sprung around this questions. After 200 years, though, a discovery of toxic substances in the locks of the composer's hair may finally solve the mystery. The story began a few years ago when DNA researchers had an examination of Beethoven's hair, and they found high and deep levels of lead poisoning in Beethoven's body that made it all the way to his hair. One of Beethoven's locks had 258 micrograms of lead per gram of hair, and the other had 380 micrograms. A normal level in hair is less than 4 micrograms.
Wow.
Highest values that people have ever seen in samples, so say these researchers. It also had arsenic levels 13 times the normal high, mercury levels that were 4 times as high. They don't know why or how all these toxic chemicals found their way into Beethoven's body. That remains to be seen. I'm sure there'll be more research and stories about this down the road, but there it is.
Wow. Where are you reading from?
From the New York Times yesterday. The Mystery of Beethoven.
That's an incredible story.
Yeah. Can you imagine? I mean, that little tiny clip we played was just a drop in the bucket of the ocean of the genius of Beethoven. Mm-hmm. If you've never indulged in Beethoven for whatever reason, awkwardness, fear, do yourself a favor and sit one evening, maybe with a pair of headphones on or in front of your bookshelf speakers, and listen to Beethoven. You will truly hear the glory of God.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to think that at one time, people thought that lead was good for us.
Right.
You know, lead was in gasoline for the longest time, right? But lead was in all sorts of things.
Paint.
It was in paint. But it was, not only was it not seen as not bad, it was seen as good for us.
Yes, not a detriment.
Right.
But you can imagine 200 plus years ago, you know, what the environments people were wading through.
Right.
And we're so careful today, but even in midst of our carefulness, we are all still poisoned. Right.
There was a story just yesterday, the mayor talking about leaded pipes in Pittsburgh City Schools.
Sure. and look at plastics on top of that and whatnot. We are all byproducts of our environment. But Beethoven, that's a whole other story, isn't it? Okay, let's take a quick break, come back, reset. We're just getting underway. It's the Wednesday edition of Pittsburgh's Christian Talk. It's The Ride Home.
We're happy to have Kathy Keller back on the program. Kathy formerly served as Assistant Director of Communications for Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City, a church that she co-founded with her late husband, Tim. Kath is the author of Jesus, Justice, and Gender Roles, A Case for Gender Roles in Ministry, and she's the co-author with Tim of several books that are terrific that we'll talk about as the show goes on. But we're always excited to talk to her and always really thrilled that she takes the time to speak with us. Kath, welcome back.
Why, thank you so much. What's the weather in Pittsburgh like?
Gorgeous.
Perfect. It's 71 and sunny, Kath.
How about... You are kidding.
No,
it's incredible. Yeah.
Well, it's only in the high 50s here, but two of the flowering trees have already broken into bloom. So I hope that groundhog's right.
Well, we love them here. We're lifting them up. We're having a little dance with Phil, for sure. Yeah. Okay, so Kath, thanks for making time for us, because I know that you've got company coming soon and you're ready to set up the cheese and crackers. But what's going to happen, though, is a big deal here to talk about Tim's work. Tell us about where you are in this gathering and what's about to happen.
Well, back in 2022, a couple of years back now, Tim and I started a 501c3, or a charitable organization, called Keller Content Development that's being run by Craig and Lisa Ellis. Craig was formerly Tim's assistant, but both of them have their degrees from Harvard School of Business, so they're not slouches. Anyway, the idea is to find innovative ways to get Tim's content to people who aren't going to sit down and read a book. And the thing that Tim worked on up till almost the last minute that he really wanted to finish was something that we called the Lucy Catechism, because Tim was trying it out on Lucy, our oldest granddaughter. Hmm. But the real name is You Have Heard It Said, and it's a counter. This is the first project that Keller Content Development's working on, and they're just putting it into beta tests, so it's not going to be... don't go asking where you can buy it, because it's not at that point yet. But You Have Heard It Said means the world's telling you this about how to be happy, how to have good relationships, how to have a successful life. But you have heard it said, but I say to you, is what Jesus kept saying, the Sermon on the Mount. He had an alternate narrative. And our children are being constantly inundated with these messages from the world, whether it's social media or movies or music or anything, that you have to have XYZ 100 different things in order to be successful at life. But Jesus has a whole different narrative. And so teaching children, originally we wanted to aim this at middle schoolers and then decided high school, college was the more appropriate age, because they would be more understanding of what a cultural narrative is. The idea is to help children see, or teens, college students see, identify the cultural narrative that's behind the commercial, the movie, the TV show, and then replace it with the one that Jesus has given us. So as an example, when he was working on this with our granddaughter Lucy, who will be a teenager by the time it comes out, he said, "Lucy, have you ever seen a movie or heard a song or anything like that that tells you to look into your heart and find out your truth is in your heart? You know what your heart says. Follow your heart." And she rolled her eyes, as only a 13-year-old can do, and said, "Only every Disney movie ever made." So I gave her real points for being
good.
Able to identify that. That the Frozen song, "Let it go, let it go. I'm going to do what makes me happy." That was like the national anthem for a while.
It sure was.
In fact, I think more people knew the words to it than do know the words to the national anthem. But at any rate, the meeting that you're talking about, the cheese and crackers today, auditioning might not be the right word, but we are meeting with an artistic design group to talk about ways in which this can be designed. And one of the things that they're thinking about is having a bank vault of video clips from things like movies or commercials or TV shows that the teacher could draw on as they saw them appropriate for the audience that they're teaching, their church, their school, their youth group, whatever it would be. They wouldn't need to use any of them or all of them or whatever, but they could also put examples that they found themselves. So anyway, we need to find the right people to partner with to make this a engaging and illuminating project that has age-appropriate art. And these are the people that are coming over to meet with and eat cheese and crackers, presumably.
Yes. And so,
better.
This is a kind of a new wave, isn't it, Kath? Because, I mean, initially you said this is for people who are not going to read a book, and it is the culture, which, of course, we are all awash in, but especially someone like Lucy, new culture. So how do you engage a generation that's not really interested in drilling down into the black and white on the page, but you still want to reach to talk about the culture, but you have to use the culture?
Well, this is not primarily going to be evangelism, although it has a certain, like everything that Tim ever did, it will have an evangelistic focus, but it will mainly be used in churches with youth groups, Sunday school classes, that sort of thing. At Tim's memorial service, a young woman came with her parents and heard us talking about this in the dinner that we had afterwards, and she started jumping up and down. She's a sophomore at Harvard. I need this, I need this, I need this, because she's a professing Christian, and yet she's aware of all these cultural narratives that are being expressed in her classes and from other students, and she doesn't know how to counter them. So this is sort of giving churchgoers and professing Christian teens and college students the ability to dissect what's being thrown at them and the ammunition to answer it. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be something that's primarily aimed at people who don't profess faith at all. But I think that if one of those people were to see it, and certainly they're, you know, let's not kid ourselves, our youth groups and our Sunday school classes are full of kids who aren't professing faith, whether they're sitting in the seats or not. They will be engaged, you know, and say, I didn't see that. That kind of snuck up on me.
Kathy Keller's with us, author of Jesus, Justice, and Gender Roles, also co-author with her husband, Tim, of The Meaning of Marriage, Facing the Complexities of Commitment with the Wisdom of God. Kathy, you mentioned that young woman from Harvard said, I need this because I know the messages that the culture is sending. And that's probably one type of student. And then there's another type of student, which because, you know, we're all swimming in the same soup, we're all the frogs in the pot where the temperature is just very slowly going up. We don't recognize the messages that the culture is sending to us because we're just so used to it. Talk about reaching that type of student.
That would be a different curriculum, I think. The way apologetics, frank, straight-out apologetics, will be part of this curriculum, but we need to go in 100 different directions to talk to kids and adults to say, this is how cultural narratives are affecting you, realize it or not, and therefore don't let it happen to you all unawares. There are a whole lot of different ways that you can slice that. I mean, the preaching at Redeemer has always been both to Christians and non-Christians. Now, if you don't believe, this is how this would affect you. But if you are a believer, you should feel as though it's an obligation for you to deal justly in your business and not short people. I was just reading a scripture the other day that says, you bad people, you can't wait for the Sabbath to be over so you can sell your wares, and you even sweep the wheat off the floor and mix it with dust and sell that at the same price. Hmm. I mean, price gouging already, you know, being condemned in scripture. So that's what this Keller content development is going to do, essentially. This is just the very first shot out of the stable to say, well, you know, let's see how we can do this. Let's find our way. Let's find people that we really are convinced can help us do this. I think they picked a hard first project, to be honest with you, and that's Tim's fault because he really wanted to see this, true, see the light of day. He worked right up to, I mean, even in his hospital bed, he was still working on the Lucy Catechism. So, wow. I think anything else that was just aimed at adults, apologetics, would have been an easier thing to do because we know how to speak to adults. But this is has a lot more components, being age appropriate in language and in design, etc.
What a strange thing it must be for you, Kath, to go from talking to Tim about this. This is, I'm thinking about this, your back and forth that you did for decades with each other, to all of a sudden opening up to a wider group of people who, you know, weren't nearly as intimate or didn't have the wherewithal to have this conversation. And now there's you, and you're kind of acting as one of the interpreters or the stewards of this. It's a totally different feel, isn't it?
Well, it's a different feel. It's not in my wheelhouse, mm-hmm, and it's emotionally draining.
I bet it is. All those things.
There's a couple of organizations. There's not just Keller Content Development that's supposed to be doing this new and innovative projects, but there's also Gospel in Life, which you can find at gospelinlife.com, which has the stewardship of all Tim's recorded sermons, and they're all for free, by the way. You just go on the website and you can get them for free. But it sends podcasts and it, you know, delivers books. It's talking about translation into other languages, Tim's preaching being translated. And then there's Redeemer City to City, which Tim went and worked for. He was chairman of the board, and also he was the one who went and did conferences in Seoul and Cape Town and Kuala Lumpur and Rio and whatnot for training church planters to reach their cities. So they have some of Tim's intellectual content as well. So managing, working to steward all of those appropriately and coming up with appropriate agreements. I mean, all that administrative stuff, I'm just 100% incompetent. Thank goodness I have my sons helping me. One of them is in business and he knows his onions as far as that. And another one's in city planning, so he's good at management with people. And another's a pastor, so he tones me down when I get a little bit too jeeped up. Mm-hmm. Let's be a little more pastoral here, Mom. Okay. But yeah. I have been trying, and all the boys are too, to familiarize ourselves with what we're really being stewards of, which means re-listening to all the sermons that Tim preached and reading the books, even the ones that I helped edit. And that makes Tim sort of ever-present.
Yeah.
I mean, to click on and watch him with a happy, joyful look on his face preaching, you know, I just won the armor of God is on the, you know, the breastplate of righteousness and the belt of truth and all of that. And then when it's over, he's not in the other room. So it has an emotionally draining component.
I bet it does. Yeah, you're traveling a road that few surviving spouses are traveling because Tim's always there with you, even more so, and voice and image and all that, right?
Yeah, I know. Yes, he's always there. But, you know, people, with the best of motives, people come up and say, oh, you know, we're so sorry for your loss, or, you know, I hear that you've lost your husband. I said, no, I didn't lose him. I know right where he is. He's just not here.
Oh,
I didn't lose him.
That's the part that's hard. He's not here, but I know where he is.
Right.
That's good.
Well, Kath, as you go through these stages, these phases,
it's a long road.
It is a long road. And all I can say is that you have a lot of people who pray for you and who value you, not just as some kind of, you know, addendum to Tim.
Tim's legacy. Yeah.
Right. But as just who you are. And so we'll continue to keep you in prayer. And as you, as you process through that, mm-hmm. It's a lot.
Yeah, and also keep this whole project in prayer. You have heard it said, because it's new territory. It's breaking new ground.
That's cool.
We've never attempted to put Tim's content into any other form than a book or a sermon.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all new stuff.
All very exciting, and I'm sure a little mildly terrifying as well.
Hmm? Yeah, not even mildly. I put it a little higher on the dial than mildly.
Give it a good 9 and for the terrifying. Kath, thanks as always. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Okie doke. Yep.
Enjoy the cheese and crackers.
Yeah. Greetings from Pittsburgh, PA, where all is right and well, at least in this corner. It used to be that flying was a luxury, that it was for a special sort of lifted experience,
mm-hmm.
right?
And you had to
dress appropriately.
You had to be your best.
Yes.
Because you were kind of doing a little social climbing if you chose to fly.
Without a doubt. Now, it's a cesspool out there. Airport security officials in Miami found a slithering surprise last week, a bag of snakes hidden in a passenger's pants as the passenger tried to board the airplane.
Oh, my God.
According to the Transportation and Security Administration, officers at the Miami International Airport found the bag of snakes hidden in the passenger's trousers at a checkpoint. The post included a photo of two small snakes that were found in what appeared to be a sunglass bag. Mm-hmm. No action was taken against the passenger. The snakes were taken away. The passenger was allowed to board. No word, of course, whether these snakes were rare, protected, anything like that. The TSA will comment later.
How about any word on why you would put those in your pants?
Remember Snakes on Planes?
I never watched it.
Well, I saw a photograph of these snakes. To be fair, they are small-ish.
It matters not.
Right. Can you imagine being in a plane and seeing snakes roll down the aisle, slither down the aisle? That would scare the heck out of you.
So what? I need more information. Why would you do that?
I have no idea.
Was it yesterday? I think it was, that another woman from Greensburg was detained at the Pittsburgh International Airport
with a loaded handgun.
Yeah, with
a bullet in the chamber.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, I need more
to kill snakes.
I need more information on that too.
No, why?
Like, because what is she thinking? Is she thinking I'm going on an airplane to shoot someone, or is she just so absent-minded she doesn't know?
It's just the casualness of guns.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for coming along. The 5 o'clock hour of The Ride Home. With last night's storms and the tornado warnings and whatnot, the good news is a tornado did not touch down.
Right.
Right. There was plenty of, like, sirens going off. And I mean, is there a way to not be involved in that?
You with your phone exploding?
Yeah, because I was at the theater a couple of weeks ago, and there was a similar thing. It was during a live performance. Everybody's phones went crazy.
Right, right.
So,
well, they don't want you to be able to disable it for your own safety. But, I mean, the volume with which it goes off.
Holy smokes.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you just like, you. I sat bolt upright.
Right. Were you asleep?
Yes. Of course I was. Bolt upright. I thought, Jesus is coming. This is what's happening
now. But
these
are the trumpets.
This is it, right. I mean,
trumpets don't sound as good as I expected, but
really scary. I did not like that at all. And of course, you know, my dog's shivering. I'm shivering too. And the cats are running crazy.
So your cats were in bed with you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And unhappy, of course.
Right.
Digging their claws somewhere into my pink flesh. I believe so.
Lexi, you shared in the first hour of the program that that you didn't stay in your apartment last night.
No, I went down to my apartment's basement and...
waiting for company.
Yeah, just to see, you know, because the basement is the safest place in a tornado.
Yeah, sure.
And so I protected me and my two cats by putting them, one in a carrier and one on a harness and a leash like a dog.
You're good. You're very good.
And we were hanging out down there
Hour. Were they like, Mom, what are we doing?
Oh, yeah. They hated every minute of it.
Sure.
I did try to... peruse, like, or excite them with chew retreats. They did not give a hoot nor a holler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, so you're in like the laundry section of your.
Yeah, I'm sitting there. No one else is down there.
No one else
cared enough.
Too bad you couldn't done a load of whites or something.
I know. Yeah. I could have really gotten some stuff done if it was a longer warning, I guess.
Heck yeah. What the
hell? Oh, that's really
the
sad.
The age we live in.
Yeah,
right?
That's mm-hmm. what it is. Pretty anyway, good. Thank goodness. If you missed any part of our 4 o'clock hour, you can find more information about it online, wherever you get your podcast, The Ride Home with John and Kathy. So we've been without power here in at 7 Parkway Center for a good portion of the day.
Oh, yeah.
So we're on generator power. So we have some lights that work, but we can't print anything.
Nothing.
My computer, which has a battery life of, I proved it, about 5 minutes, is now dead. So,
right.
Yeah, I'm working with no papers today.
No, it'd be nice to go to the woods. Right. If you lived in the woods, you wouldn't miss any of this and no one would care. But here we are, like, you know, waiting for the printer to come back online. Like our lives depend upon it.
I mean, good grief.
Holy smokes.
Anyway, coming up in the rest of today's show, three kinds of people you need in your life. Daniel Darling will be with us in just a couple minutes. Also, a certain percentage of Americans apparently have never felt more uninspired at work.
That's horrible, isn't it?
I mean, what?
What? I get it. Okay, we'll talk about it.
Okay, we'll talk about it anyway. And does this make sense? Mm-hmm. But before we do any of that, John, I know it's a Wednesday.
Yeah.
And it's out of the ordinary, but I'm ready for a 5 and 5.
Hey. Oh, the music works.
We didn't do it yesterday, 5 and 5.
Right.
And so I figured today would be a good...
Throw it in there.
Yeah, so would you please get out a writing implement?
How does this work?
I'm going to give you 5 things, John, and you're going to rank them.
All right.
And you can rank them however you want to rank them.
Thank you.
It's completely.
I was thinking about the last time we did this.
Yep.
And I was thinking about Star Wars and Close Encounters.
Yep.
Debating of whether I made a mistake or not.
Oh, with your sci-fi list.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Anyway.
This is a little similar.
All right, good.
Ocean's 11.
Oh.
Gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Monuments Men. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Up in the Air. These are all George Clooney movies.
Yes, they are.
He celebrated a birthday yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. So he was on my mind.
All right. George Clooney movies.
Now, there are many I could have added.
Oh, yeah. Sure, sure.
I mean, for goodness sake, I could have put Michael Clayton in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Syriana is a movie I've never seen that he won an Oscar for. I don't even know what that is.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
He was in ER, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We could have, did I mention, oh, we could have done Batman, Robin, for goodness sake.
Okay, I'm good.
Are we?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's fast.
Okay, 1 to 5.
Yeah, please start at number 5,
okay.
If you would.
Okay, number 5 would be Monuments Men.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
I have.
Exactly. You kind of made the face. I mean, it was fine.
I wanted it to be better than it ended
Always.
Up being.
Always, because you've seen George Clooney enough where you love the guy.
Of course.
Right? And so every time you kind of, he's on the...
This is going to be great.
Yeah.
And it's a great story.
But just an okay film. No. Number 5. Number 4 would be Up in the Air.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that?
Yes.
And?
Oh, it's a heartbreaker.
It is a heartbreaker.
Oh, it's a heartbreaker.
Unexpected, right?
I mean, was so shocked.
Me too.
Oh.
And it's, they're having such a good time.
Oh,
but,
no, don't
spoiler,
say anything.
I'm not. No. Okay. But I did love it. Yeah.
Oh. Excellent.
Up in the Air. Number 3 would be Gravity.
No, I did not see that.
Oh, that's Sandra Bullock.
Yeah.
And George Clooney. And again, no spoilers.
Yeah.
It's a sci-fi space thing, and it's horrific. They're both fabulous. And it's a short film. It's not that, maybe it's an hour and a half max.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but highly recommended.
Okay.
Number two would be Ocean's 11, which the ensemble cast alone and all the, you know, the revelry. I mean, those guys, they just like working together.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, how many Oceans have
there
been?
Yeah, I don't know.
Four,
but there have been
five
a lot.
Of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, these are people just, you know.
It was so good.
Yeah.
I mean, if you haven't seen it for a while, you kind of forget how good the original one was.
Yeah. As a Julia Roberts.
Yep.
Right? It's kind of funny you
Elliot
brought this
Gould.
Up. Yep. Because my kid just sent me a photo of him the other day watching TV, and the TV's in the distance, and Brad Pitt's in the driver's seat, and there's Julia Roberts and George Clooney in the back seat. And I'm looking at the, oh, that's Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
Okay, the number one film. Of course, it has to be Forever and Ever. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
There can't be even a close competitor.
I don't think so. With the hairnet
and
the pomade. What?
And the pomade.
I mean,
I'm a Dapper Dan man.
And the singing.
Right.
I mean, Alison Krauss in the soundtrack.
Oh my gosh, the baptism.
It's so funny. It's so.
She done loved him up and turned him into a horny toad.
It's a great film. If you've never seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, please watch it tonight.
Anyone skilled in the metallurgical arts?
That's our 5 at 5. We'll take a quick break, come back. We're getting underway for the 5
o'clock. It's a geographical oddity. 2 weeks from everywhere.
Road of life is long, and on that journey, you need some good people around you. Well, Dan Darling is back with us. Daniel Darling is the author of several books, including The Dignity Revolution, The Characters of Christmas, The Unlikely People Caught Up in the Story of Jesus, and The Characters of Easter, The Villains, Heroes, Cowards, and Crooks Who Witness History's Biggest Miracle. But Dan's prolific on social media, and he wrote a piece about three kinds of people you need in your life, and here to talk to us about that is Daniel Darling. Daniel, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back with you all on the radio.
So tell us about people. You've been focusing on, you know, important groups in your last few books.
Christmas, Easter,
right,
and whatnot.
Right. So tell us about this.
Yeah. So this is one of my, I have a newsletter that you could subscribe to. It's called One Little Word. This was, I was thinking about three important kinds of people you need in your life. Obviously, God made us to live in community, and we flourish best when we have good friendships, good relationships. We're not made to live alone. And I talked about really three people I think that are important for success, and, you know, three kinds of friends. One is parents and or mentors, but parents, people function as surrogate fathers and mothers and our actual parents. But the second one are peers, and people kind of in the same life stage as we are. And then proteges, people who are sort of few miles behind us, perhaps, that we're helping to encourage and mentor along the way.
Parents, peers, and proteges. Daniel, a friend of mine was telling me about their student teaching days, and the students wanted to know, you know, how did you get this? How did this work? So the student teacher was, you know, in her early 20s. Her students were like 15, 16 years of age. So as the student teacher told the story, the student said, "Wow, you must have both parents," as though this was like a newfound revelation, because these kids, obviously, the students did not have both parents. And so, I mean, we take it for granted, of course, if you've got a mom and a dad who are, you know, showing up with you throughout your life, but a lot of kids don't have that.
That's right. And, you know, there's been so much research done by folks like Brad Wilcox and others to show that, you know, the impact when kids don't have both parents in the home. But nevertheless, I do think folks who grow up in that situation, you know, they can compensate for that, and the Lord can use them by bringing into their life maybe surrogate parents and surrogate fathers. And even all of us, even those of like myself who had two wonderful parents, you know, we need folks along the way who are mentors and surrogate fathers and mothers, and really in various seasons of life or different fields, right? So when I pastored, I had a couple of older pastors who had been there before and could really help guide me and save me from making poor decisions, so I could go to for feedback. They're real mentors. They believed in me. They saw God's hand on me, and they affirmed me in my calling. That's very, very important for me to have. And I think folks should seek those out. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're in a particular field, or even as you're parenting or different walks of life, to have those sort of mentors and surrogate mothers and fathers.
Yeah. We had a good friend. We still have a good friend, but he went to the Naval Academy. And when his parents took him to drop him off on the first day, you know, there's the line, apparently, where, you know, you walk across and you're part of the Navy. And but before you walk across, you're not yet. And his dad turned to him and he said, whatever you do, find another person, another man to hold you accountable.
That's really good. And so this friend
of ours now is probably in his early 70s, and he has always done that. No matter where he was in his life, he took his father's advice that seriously. And so seeing how other people have made him what he is one of my favorite things about him.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's, you know, I think we have to be intentional about that and say, who is a few miles ahead of me who could give me some wisdom, I can go for coffee with, I can get to know. Who can help save me and guide me and affirm me. And then I think the other group of folks we need are peers, you know, people who are sort of in our same station of life that we can kind of do this with.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, parenting, for instance, you know, I think having other parents who are in the same journey where you are, maybe your kids are at similar ages, or even people in your same sort of field or same life stage at church. And you can sort of, you know, sharpen each other. You can have that camaraderie and that friendship. You can go through seasons of life together. I think it's very, very important to have those. And I think especially, I think for men and women, but I think it's harder for men to do that, but I think it's really important.
Yeah. And there's an intentionality, Daniel, right? I mean, few people kind of go, well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, you know, have a protege. I'm going to have a protege. I'm going to breathe into someone. Someone has had to have a protege. You had to be a protege in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. Someone took an interest in you so that you could pass it down the road.
That's right. I mean, I think we have to be intentional about cultivating our friendships to say, I'm going to find a mentor or two that can help me with this. I'm going to find someone who's a peer, you know, people who, you know, and these are people that you would call in a crisis or people you would call to get advice about an important decision or career move or something you have to deal with. And then, you know, I think the third group is a protege to say, okay, who can I affirm who might be a few miles behind me that I could affirm? And I think it's really important as we get older to do this intentionally, to come alongside folks. And we underestimate the value of going to someone and saying, look, I see God's hand on you. I see these gifts that you have. I just want to affirm you in this. I want to encourage you. I want to help you. I want to be here for you if you need anything. And to do that intentionally and proactively, you know, Paul had Barnabas, right? Barnabas was the one who saw what God was doing in Paul's life, put his arm around him and said, I see this and I want to help guide you. But then Paul also had Timothy. You know, he sought out Timothy on his second missionary journey and said, here's a young man that I see gifts in that I want to take and mentor and shape, and he was a son in the faith. I think all of us need to do that, you know, men and women to do that, you know, older women seeing maybe younger women in the church and saying, hey, I've been where you've been, and I know the struggles, and I just want to encourage you and help you any way I can. It's such an important ministry to do.
We're talking to Dan Darling. We're talking about the people that matter most in life. You've brought up parents, peers, proteges. How do you know when you've moved into a portion of life where you need to be willing to be someone's protege? I know sometimes it feels weird. I had a friend come up to me a few weeks ago and she said, there's this person at work and they said, you know, they want to kind of be my protege, but I don't want to turn out like them. What do I say? I said, talk us through that.
Well, and I think, you know, I think we can be awkward. I mean, I don't think I've ever gone to someone older than me and said, will you be my mentor? You know, I think it's one of those things where it's like, hey, can I go out for coffee with you? Can I pick your brain on a few things? We just developed that relationship. I was intentional with it. And so I think we have to be intentional. And sometimes we have all these relationships at the same time, right? I'm in a stage of life where I have a bunch of peers who are my age who are going through life together. We have all teenagers as kids. We're all in similar places in ministry. But I also have younger folks who I try to disciple and mentor and encourage. But then I have a number of older folks who are maybe a few miles ahead of me who are sort of surrogate fathers and mentors at this place in my life. And we may be in that place where we have all three. Now, I think as we progress through life, you know, the older we get, we may have more folks that we're mentoring than are mentoring us. We're maybe in a stage of life where we're kind of a sage. I do want to encourage older folks, especially older Christians, that this season of your life is so rich and so valuable. You have so much to give to younger generations of Christians who do not have the benefit of your wisdom and experience. And there's a real opportunity to be intentional and encourage the next generation.
That's really good. That's a really good word, Dan. I mean, and I think especially this is true for men, because men are, you know, least likely to connect. Women just seem to have that gift and, you know, and they make it work. But guys tend to sort of be back on their heels, yeah?
You know, I think you're right. And, you know, I think especially for guys in church and men, guys will never admit it, but young men who are fathers, who are really trying to do the right thing, trying to be good dads and good husbands, you know, there's a lot of insecurities that guys have to say, am I doing this right? Am I failing? Am I, yep. You know, to have an older father, husband to say, look, you can do this. I know it's, you're trying to balance all this and I've been where you've been. Let me just encourage you. You can do this. And for older women to do that, for younger moms mm-hmm. who might feel overwhelmed. Maybe you've got 2-3 kids, you know, hanging off your arms and just how am I going to keep this together, and have an older, dear, sweet woman say, you know, look, I want to help you. I want to encourage you. You can do this. You can get through this. I've been where you've been.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah. So, Dan, with only a couple minutes left, can you talk about some of the people who talk about your mom and dad or your peers or the proteges, or how has this worked in your own life?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, I had the benefit of 2 really great parents. And my mom passed away last year, but my dad is still alive. And, I have a great father. I realize not everyone had the benefit of a good, godly father in life, but I did. And, you know, he's very quiet, but led by example and showed me what it is to work and to be faithful and to honor the Lord, and took us to church and was a leader in our church, you know, a lay leader. I've also had other mentors who have been so good to me. You know, when I had my first church, had an older pastor who was the intern before me, and just sort of put his arm around me like a Barabbas, and not only affirmed that, hey, you can do this, but here's some things you want to consider. Here's how to avoid these things. He probably saved me from making really foolish leadership decisions when I was young and very inexperienced. And I've had those sorts of people all through my life. And then, you know, I have a group of peers, of friends that I think of a group that we're on a text thread, you know, with pastors from around the country, 4 or 5 of us. And, you know, we've been through ups and downs and triumphs and sorrows together. We're raising our children together. And, man, I don't know what I'd do without that group of men who are just, you know, we can share, we can laugh together, we can cry together. All those things is so important. And then I love being in an academic institution now where we have these young college students coming through. And, you know, I'm able to help give them advice, and you know, they're thinking about, what am I going to do in my future, what should I do, this and this, and I can help them walk through this. I can come along and say, hey, I see you have a gift here, you have a gift here, and what have you thought about pursuing this, or maybe even open doors for them. That's one thing that a mentor or a father figure or a mother figure can do for younger generations, besides encouragement, is opening doors to yep. say, hey, I know someone, let me open this door, let me connect you with this person. And try to advance you and where God's taking you.
Yeah, that is so incredibly powerful, isn't it? I mean, it goes to the adage, right? Oftentimes, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Someone can help push you along a little bit. And, you know, everybody needs a little bit of help to open up a door once in a while.
That's exactly right. And I think one of the things I've said myself, and I think we should commit to this, that when I was coming up in my career, there was a lot of people who opened doors for me, gave me opportunities that really shouldn't have.
Yeah.
And I look back and why did they take a chance on me? And I've always said, you know, I want to be in a position where I can open doors for others. I can connect them with this person, or I can do this and whatever. To kind of repay that.
Yeah, I agree. I'll never forget, whenever I was first starting out, I talked to a friend of a friend. He said, oh, I know some guy. And I met this guy on the phone. We literally would talk for an hour or more almost every week for more than a year. And Dan, I never met this guy face-to-face person. Never met him in person. No, he was incredible. He helped me immeasurably.
Wow.
And he was just, you know, one of those voices of encouragement and experience and wisdom. It changed my life for the better forever. And he was just doing it because he wanted to do it. That's all.
Wow.
So there's a lot of good people out there. I mean, and your point, especially, I think, Dan, that I take away from the three people is that, especially for us older people, if you know, make yourself available, be wholly available to that younger generation, because my guess is somebody helped you along the way.
That's exactly right. And you just don't know the power of coming alongside someone, especially coming up and trying to figure out who they are, and say, look, I've watched you. I've observed you. I think you have some gifts here. I think you should pursue this. Or, I want to help you here. I want to encourage you. it's huge.
Sure,
I mean,
is.
It's huge. I remember when I was a young person and someone said, hey, I think you have a gift to write. And I think you, God's gifted you this way. You should pursue that. I mean, that was like gold. Hmm. You know, I took that and ran with it.
I bet. Okay. So talk about, that's a segue to One Little Word. I mean, our listeners, they can jump in on that. Yeah.
Yes. So you go to my website, danieldarling.com. You could sign up for my newsletter, One Little Word, and I'd love to have you as part of that community and get fresh ideas and on leadership, on the Christian life and parenting and all these kinds of things, cultural issues. So love to have you part of that.
Very nice.
Dan Darling is the author of a whole bunch of books, including The Dignity Revolution, The Unlikely People Caught Up in the Story of Jesus, and The Characters of Easter.
Dan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you. Love you guys so much and grateful for the ministry that you have there.
And for you as yours and your wisdom.
Thanks, Dan.
We'll take a quick break, come back. It's the Daily Feature.
Does this make sense?
Does this make sense?
Does this make sense?
Does what make sense?
Classic stage musicals.
You mean like
The King and I,
Guys and Dolls,
Music Man,
1776,
Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, Gypsy,
Chess,
42nd Street.
All those make 100% sense.
Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh yeah. The genre of the American musical theater is a gift to the world. It makes perfect sense.
Oklahoma.
Excellent. You hate Oklahoma, though.
I do hate Oklahoma.
First act is fabulous. Mm. Are you saying you don't like them?
I love them so much.
Oh, good.
That when I see, like, MJ the musical, you know what I mean? I love Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Love Michael Jackson.
It's a cash grab.
It's a cash grab. You know it's a cash grab.
Sure it is.
The ABBA thing.
I don't
Mamma Mia, we know that's a cash grab.
Although it's like the Jersey Boys?
I thought it was a cash grab until I went to
of
see
course,
it, and it was
right?
so epic.
Right.
And I loved it
yeah,
so
exactly,
much. I
right?
was I could not believe how great it was.
It's a bio stage.
I could not believe how great
right,
it was.
Right.
But still, if you're comparing newer ones, and of course Hamilton's great. Of course. But Kimberly Akimbo, I haven't seen it. Beautiful Noise, do you know it?
Mm-mm.
Okay, those are all newer ones. Wicked, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Dear Evan Hansen.
Right. Beautiful music.
Yeah.
But don't
it's
you
not,
think the classics make sense?
It's not Oscars and Hammerstein.
Some
right?
people think it doesn't make sense. Some people think we should only be doing the new stuff.
Get out of here.
I think they're wrong.
No. Have you seen Hair?
Oh, yeah.
Godspell?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ Superstar?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But I feel like there's a space for pick a little, talk a little. Don't you think there is?
100%. Yeah. Cheap. Talk a lot, pick a little. Okay, from the magnificent,
yeah,
the American musical theater makes sense, to the ridiculous. Does this make sense? A whisk broom?
What?
The whisk broom.
Well, sorry, I just have to adjust.
I mean, we do this 5 days a week.
Right, no, you're right.
They all can't be home runs.
Okay.
The whisk broom.
Is that like one of the round ones?
No, it's like, you know, the umpire uses it or someone cleans the inside of their car.
Sure.
Stan.
Right. My dad, are you kidding
me? The whisk broom.
Right. Oh.
A generation of people, of men, who in their car, when they would get out of the car, they would do what?
Right. They would just sweep it out.
Yeah.
Just use your little, right?
Your little
right.
whisk broom.
Mm-hmm. It makes all the sense. And I'm someone who loves a vacuum.
Yeah.
You know, a stick vacuum.
Sure,
that you
sure.
can, that has its place. But you're never going to get away from the stick broom.
That's a good cleaning.
No, it is.
All right.
It makes sense.
Do you ever find yourself sitting at work, staring at your computer screen or whatever it is you're doing for your work, and you just can't seem to muster up the motivation to get things done?
Yeah, I have felt that way.
Yeah, it
but I don't
familiar.
Feel that way every day.
No, but it does. The malaise does strike you, right?
Yeah.
Well, in fact, more than a third of Americans, 38%, have never felt more uninspired at the work that they do. The survey conducted by Talker Research and commissioned by Lifetime Work polled 2,500 employed Americans and found that this lack of inspiration is directly impacting productivity. Mm-hmm. Another 38% of respondents admitted to feeling only somewhat productive at work, with those working in suburban areas being hit the hardest, 41%. So what is the deal with this productivity slump? It turns out that our work setting plays a significant role. Survey revealed that 37% of those who work a routine consider it to be stale, especially those mm-hmm. who work fully in person. But it's not just about the physical space. The people also said the community around our workspace have a profound effect on our community and our productivity.
That is so true.
62% of respondents said that the individuals and community surrounding their workspace positively influence their productivity.
Yes. Yeah.
So working from home.
Working at home, you can't bounce off one another. I mean, I think there was a line in there. Where were you reading from?
From Study Finds.
Okay. One of the sentences that it included there was the fact that people get annoyed with having to do the same thing day after day, especially when they're working from the office. Well, try doing the same thing day after day when you're working from home.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that that's like a great improvement.
No, it isn't. I mean, okay, so today, so we're all here at the office. All of a sudden, in the middle of recording something with Lex in there, the power goes off. I mean, the whole building just kind of shut down.
Yeah, so this was post-tornado watch by many hours.
And it's weird. I've witnessed this over the years I've been here. It's like the whole building sort of convulses. And you can feel the machinery go, goo, goo. It makes this huge kind of like hiccup.
Mm.
And then everything comes to a standstill. So everybody comes out of their offices and we kibbutz with each other, you know.
Right.
And then, of course, you know we're off the air. But there's this interaction, this engagement of how do we get this thing back up together again. You know, you're waiting for Randy, our engineer, to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't do that at home.
No, right? You wouldn't do that at home. I mean, if the power went out. I mean,
what do you do, right?
What, you're going to text somebody and say, hey, the power's out.
And we couldn't do anything here, but just the fact that we were all together, sort of like on this weird journey together, it kind of made it fun.
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of like a snow day in
a way. Listen, I know that I have worked in offices over the years that have been the opposite of fun. So I get it. When when you've got the wrong personalities together, it's not like you're excited to show up at 8 a.m. So I totally get that.
Right.
But I also think that we think we're doing ourselves a favor by encouraging working from home. And I'm just seeing with more and more people in my personal life and in a lot of reading that I do on a daily basis, that people are suffering the consequences of too much isolation.
Yep.
We know that that was the case during COVID. Why can't we recognize that that could be the case right now?
Well, I think the good news is people are getting this. Don't you see? I mean, the traffic is heavier now. Parking lots are fuller.
Yeah,
right?
They are fuller.
So slowly, we are returning to normal.
But if I'm looking at the stuff that I read on a daily basis, just, you know, people who are talking about, you know, what work looks like in America.
Yeah, and like what we just read about the survey.
People commenting. It's almost like the understanding before the article begins is that we all know that working at home is better.
Right.
And I just don't think that. I don't think that that should be something that we all agree on. Well, I know there are a lot of instances where it's great to work at home, and you certainly spend a lot less time
commuting
and going back and forth.
Your wardrobe.
But we know that isolation is a societal problem. We know that loneliness is an issue of incredible import, such that different countries around the world, I think it began in the UK, they have like the Minister of Loneliness.
Yes, right.
Because we recognize how much of an issue it is. But when we're doing it, when we're working at home 5 days a week,
it's okay.
All of a sudden it's fine. It's the best thing. I don't think it is.
But don't you know that thrill? And of course, we experienced this here, the thrill of collaboration.
Yes.
Right?
For sure. And I just don't think collaborating on Zoom is the same thing.
No, it isn't. No, I hated Zoom, didn't you?
Oh, my God.
It was the worst. Yeah.
We did the show on Zoom every day for a year and a half when we were quarantined at home.
I thought I was going to lose my mind.
Oh, my gosh.
Seriously.
But when it came time for us to come back, we also didn't want to.
Right. Which was also because you get comfortable.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. But once we were back a week.
Oh, but the exit was so fraught with
tension,
the crazy
the
tension
unknown,
and uncertainty.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, you know, when you're away all that time, you know, the corporate America is sending you these emails. It built up this gigantic wall.
It did.
Which was crazy. So anyway, people are uninspired at work. I guess that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And maybe uninspired because they are not collaborating, because they are stuck in their spare room or they're working, you know, from the coffee table. There's something about being in people's faces.
Yeah. But, and the other thing, we weren't keeping data on who was uninspired by their work 500 years ago. So you think all the stonemasons that showed up to build Notre Dame in Paris over five generations were inspired every day?
No. But they showed up.
They showed up. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, I think the reason we're thinking about how uninspired we are is because we keep asking the question, hey, are you inspired?
Right.
No one ever thought that that was something that we should consider when, you know, we were just happy to get a paycheck.
Well, there were bills to pay and mouths to feed, as always. A school teacher in San Francisco has joined an elite group of humans who have visited every nation on the planet.
Wow.
Lucy Hugh, who teaches second grade in San Jose, California, has officially visited 193 nations. Is that
cool? That's incredible.
I mean, I love it so much. She said she waited a long time. Her last country was Syria because it was closed to Americans.
Mm-hmm.
She finally traveled there 2 months ago. She was bracing herself to make sure nothing happened. She said, when I got into Syria, I felt really excited, obviously, and a little bit surreal. I couldn't believe this was actually happening. I felt very calm, like there was a sense of calm enough. Oh, I have reached my goal of 193. There is officially no tally of who's visited every country in the world, but it's estimated to be only about 400 people.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. The daughter of Vietnamese refugees, she said she didn't travel much as a child. She got her first passport at age 23. Growing up, it was a very modest upbringing. We never went anywhere. But before going back to school for her master's degree, she decided to get her passport and go backpacking throughout Europe. From there, she caught the travel bug, made it a goal to travel every summer. As her country count climbed higher and higher, she figured out how to keep her costs low and give back at the same time. She says, quote, I realized if I planned my summers properly, I could travel on a low budget, see a couple of countries that are clustered together. And then I realized by the time I've traveled for 5 or 6 years, I've reached probably 60 or 70 countries. She said she discovered networks of other international travelers in various clubs who offered tips and new destination goals. She joined the Century Club, which has the goal of hitting 100 countries. And then once she reached that goal, she figured she should keep on going. And I just thought, well, how could I go to 193? Is it possible? And then I realized, oh, you actually can go to Afghanistan safely. And you can actually go to Iran and North Korea safely.
Really?
So why not? She's 42. She said the biggest question people ask her is how she's able to afford travel so
much. That's what I was going to ask.
She's thought of a variety of cost-saving strategies, but her biggest one is by signing up to do volunteer exchange programs and homestays. She says she uses something called Work Away, which is a subscription-based website that connects volunteers with vetted organizations to find hosts and opportunities. She said she's a low-key traveler. She often stays in hostels using a website called Hostel World and has even found deals working at hostels in exchange for her room and board. She said a few other suggestions, a smaller budget, including earning credit card points to rack up rewards. She said she's also taken low-cost buses across borders and trains while on her travels. She tends to travel alone.
Really?
Can you imagine that?
Really?
She said it's important to help people to have people realize that travel is more attainable than they might think. She said there's a lot of misconceptions about travel being unattainable or that it's very unsafe or unaffordable. But for now, she said she's learned how to make trips happen and she wants to spread that knowledge. She says travel is attainable if you've learned ways to do it in a budget-conscious way. And those methods are out there if you want to research. Travel is less unattainable than people think. Her favorite country out of 193, Mongolia, stands out as her favorite. She said it's really this land of undiscovered adventure. She stayed a few days in the Gobi Desert. I've been there in a yurt, yes, with a local family. She reminisces about riding the family's camels in the morning and sliding down sand dunes with the kids. She also mentioned her love for the Kenya family, whom she stayed with for several months one summer and traveled around Eastern Africa. Quote, "The thing that really reminds me of the value of travel is just a sense of gratitude for how much we have in this world. The beauty, the experience.
Yeah.
Yet we're often unsatisfied because we want more." And she says, "I think these lessons that I bring home to me, when you want to complain about, you know, traffic or the weather or my internet's down, okay, let's stop for a moment. These people living happily with none of these things." She said the key to staying safe while traveling is to do your research ahead of time. For example, she said when she was debating about going to North Korea, she initially thought it sounded like a really stupid idea. But she said, "Once I did the research, then you realize, oh, there's actually three companies that have been taking travelers into North Korea for 8 years. How about that? Where she's off to next? Antarctica. 193
nations.
That's
incredible at the age of 42.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated with the website workaway.info. You have to see this. So, John, you can put in your destinations. So,
yeah.
Say you want to go to Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you can volunteer and work in Brazil. 293 hosts and organizations have opportunities for you to work in Brazil.
Really?
Yeah. Like, for example, you can help in English conversational classes. This one, looking for sensible people to help at our place in Athens. And then it has the descriptions.
Really? Sensible people.
Community permaculture project. A treehouse experience. Welcome to our hostel family. Be part of our family in our hostel. Help us to build an amazing place. I mean, this just goes on and on and on and on. It tells you all the different regions in the country that you've chosen, the different opportunities, where they're located, what that might look like. I mean, you can't imagine how much information is on here.
Well, she makes it, I mean, clearly it's not easy. But obviously, she's a bright person who is hyper-connected, does her research, like she said, and then not a whole lot of money. It sounds like she's out there seeing the world. Everybody says, "I wish I could travel. I wish I could travel, right? I want to do this." But few of us ever do.
Volunteer and work in Vietnam. 76 hosts and organizations are available right now on this website.
Really? Okay. Pack your bags.
I mean,
go change the world for the better forever.
Absolutely incredible. I'm going to see what's available in the Middle East, John.
Okay. What do you think?
Look at all of these opportunities in the Middle East.
No kidding. Just
by being
out there.
Egypt, Jordan, Israel.
Okay. If you could go anywhere, where would you go?
Right now?
Yeah. Travel. Anywhere. Okay. So money wasn't an expense.
Yeah.
And you just wanted to go and experience.
Yes.
Where would you go?
Croatia. Yeah.
Why?
Croatia is... It looks to me as just a gem of a place. It's on the Mediterranean, but it's not visited very often.
No. It's got to be pretty inexpensive, too.
It's pretty inexpensive, but it has so much. It's a walled city. The capital is a walled city. You can walk all around it. You should see what Zagreb looks like.
Really?
Yeah, that's my top place right now.
Okay, so on Workaway, is there Croatian possibilities to go and see what that's like?
That's a good point. I'm going to look it up. Okay.
So. I mean, we've been watching Stanley Tucci in Italy. Which is fabulous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Stanley Tucci. Of course, he speaks Italian fluently. His parents are Italian. So he goes back and visits all the cities in Italy. I mean, all these major cities. Florence, Rome. I mean,
is it incredible?
Oh. And of course, he loves food. He loves to eat, and he visits from place to place, and he eats his way through Italy. It's wonderful.
So that's where you'd pick?
Yeah, I've never been to Italy.
Right.
I've been to a lot of places, but I've never spent a minute. I would like to just get on a train and float through Italy.
Okay, that would be fine. Mm-hmm. And by the way, there are a whole lot of options for me in Croatia right now.
Of course, there are.
There are a whole lot. There's even a small horse association in a beautiful valley.
So, they provide room and board. Workaway does?
It depends. The people are willing to give you room and board in exchange for you working there or volunteering there or how. Every place has a little bit of a different situation.
I mean, talk about trusting, right? you're going to pack your bag and trust that when you show up, they're going to be cool.
I have done that. I've traveled with quite – I mean, I've had homes – I probably had 30 homestays in my life.
Right.
And I've some have been better than others, but I've never had a catastrophe.
Because people are curious,
right?
And they want to know about you like you want to know about them,
yep.
especially if you're coming from a foreign country. And what about language? I mean, what about the language barrier?
Well, that's,
she didn't talk about that.
Right. Well, that's what's really interesting, right? But you've seen that. You were in Mongolia for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Talk about language barrier.
Anyway, stay in the year. Thanks for being with us. Have yourself a great night. Say your prayers.
The Ride Home with John and Kathy. A production of Salem Media Group.